Have you ever met somebody who had everything, money, fame, a name that would outlive every airplane he ever flew, and still could not stop chasing the next horizon? I'm Taildragger, and you're listening to The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Pull up a chair, because this one stays with me every time I think about it. Today is June 2nd, and on this day, 116 years ago, a man named Charles Stuart Rolls climbed into a French-built Wright Flyer and did something nobody had ever done. He flew across the English Channel from Dover to France and back again without stopping. Round trip? No fuel stop, no landing on the other side. Just a turn over the French coast and straight back to the White Cliffs. And the thing that makes this story unforgettable is not just what he did, it is what happened to him 39 days later. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation Challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at aviationsoul.com. Now you know the name Rolls. Of course you do. Rolls-Royce. You hear it and you think of Merlin engines screaming in a Spitfire or those big turbofans hanging under a 777 wing. But before there were engines with that name stamped on them, there was a young Englishman born into wealth who could not sit still. Charles Rolls was the third son of Lord Languedoc, raised on an estate in Monmouthshire, Wales. He went to Eton. He went to Cambridge. He studied mechanical engineering, which in those days meant you were the odd one in the family, because gentlemen were not supposed to get their hands dirty, but Rolls was not interested in being a gentleman in the drawing room sense. He was interested in machines. He was one of the first men in Britain to own an automobile. By the time he was in his 20s, he was racing cars, setting speed records, and running a dealership in London, selling imported French motor cars, and that is how he met Henry Royce. Royce was the opposite of Rolls in every way that mattered on paper, self-taught, working class. A perfectionist who had built his own two-cylinder engine in a cramped Manchester workshop because he thought the existing ones were rubbish, and he was right. When Rolls drove a Royce car for the first time in 1904, he reportedly said it was the best car he had ever driven. The partnership was formed that same year, Rolls-Royce Limited. One name from the aristocracy, one from the factory floor, and together they would build some of the finest engines the world has ever seen. But here's the thing about Charles Rolls. Cars were never enough. He had already moved on, because in those early years of the 20th century, something was happening across the channel in France and in the fields of Kitty Hawk and Dayton that made automobiles feel earthbound, flight, powered, controlled, heavier than air flight. And Charles Rolls wanted in. He was already a balloon enthusiast. He had made over 170 balloon ascents by the time the Wright brothers came to Europe to demonstrate their flyer. And when Rolls saw what Wilbur Wright could do in the air at Le Mans in 1908, that was it. The automobile business became a side concern. Rolls wanted wings. He earned his Royal Aero Club Aviator's certificate. Number two, the second one ever issued in Great Britain. He bought a Wright Flyer from the Short Brothers factory on the Isle of Sheppey, one of the first production Wrights built under license in England. And he began to fly. Now here's where it gets interesting. In 1909, Louis Blériot had flown the English Channel from France to England. One way, it was a sensation. The whole world sat up and took notice, but nobody had done the round trip. Nobody had crossed and come back without landing. The channel is about 21 miles at its narrowest, Dover to Sangatte, so a round trip is roughly 42 miles over open water in an airplane made of wood, wire, and fabric, with an engine producing maybe 30 horsepower on a good day. No instruments to speak of, no radio, no life jacket that would do you any good if that engine coughed even once over the middle of the channel. You are sitting on a wooden seat, exposed to the wind, with nothing between you and the gray water below except the air moving over a pair of canvas wings. Rolls had been planning this flight for weeks. He knew the weather over the channel was fickle. Fog could roll in with almost no warning. The winds at the surface could be completely different from what you found at 300 or 400 feet. And in a Wright Flyer, you did not have the power to fight a headwind. You worked with what the sky gave you. On the morning of June 2, 1910, the conditions were acceptable, not perfect. Acceptable. A light wind from the southwest, decent visibility. Rolls took off from the cliffs near Dover and pointed the nose of his Wright Flyer toward France. Picture this. The engine buzzing behind you like an angry sewing machine. The channel below, slate gray, flecked with white caps. The French coast is a smudge on the horizon that takes forever to sharpen into detail. You have no altimeter. You judge your height by how big the waves look. You have no airspeed indicator. You judge your speed by the pressure of the wind on your face and the angle of the nose. Everything is feel, everything is instinct, everything is trust in that little engine and those fabric wings. He crossed the French coast near Sangatte.
dropped a weighted bag of letters as a marker, proof that he had actually been there, and then turned the airplane around and headed back toward England. 42 miles, roughly 90 minutes in the air. When he came back over the white cliffs of Dover, a crowd was waiting. They had watched him go, they had waited, and now they watched him come back. He landed near his starting point, and just like that, Charles Rolls had completed the first non-stop double crossing of the English Channel by airplane.
The Royal Aero Club awarded him their gold medal. The press celebrated him. He was already famous for the car company, but this was different. This was personal. This was Charles Rolls doing what Charles Rolls was put on Earth to do, pushing the edge of what a machine could accomplish with a human being at the controls. And here is where the story turns, and I will be honest with you. This is the part that is hard to tell. 39 days later, on July 12, 1910, Charles Rolls entered a flying competition at Bournemouth, a landing accuracy contest. Routine stuff by the standards of the day, which were already low. He was flying the same type of Wright Flyer. During his approach, the tail of the aircraft broke. Some accounts say it was a structural failure of the horizontal stabilizer. The airplane nosed down from about 100 feet. Charles Rolls was killed instantly. He was 32 years old. He was the first Briton to die in a powered aircraft accident. Think about that for a moment. The first in a country that would go on to produce Spitfires and Lancasters and Concordes and Harriers. The very first British life claimed by powered flight belonged to a man whose name was already stamped on the finest engines in the world. And here's what I think about every time this story comes around. Rolls did not die pushing the envelope on some reckless stunt. He died in a landing competition, a slow speed approach, a structural failure that today we would catch in a pre-flight inspection. The margins were that thin. In 1910, every flight was a test flight, every takeoff was an act of faith in materials and methods that nobody fully understood yet. Henry Royce, by the way, was devastated. He never attended an air event again, but he kept building engines, and those engines, the ones that carried the name of both men, would go on to win wars, shrink the globe, and define what power and reliability meant in aviation for the next century. The Merlin, the Griffin, the Avon, the Conway, the RB211, the Trent. All of them carry the name of a man who died in a flying accident before most of those engine types were even imagined.
What gets me is the completeness of the arc. Charles Rolls had wealth and did not waste it. He had talent and pointed it at the hardest problems of his era. He saw flight for what it was. Not a novelty, not a circus act, but the future, and he threw himself into that future with both hands. The Channel crossing on this day in 1910 was not just a stunt. It was a proof of concept. It said, this machine can go somewhere and come back. It can cross a body of water that has separated nations for all of recorded history, and it can do it before lunch. Every time you see that name on the side of a jet engine nacelle, remember the man it belongs to. Not the car, not the company, the pilot. The man who sat on a wooden seat over the English Channel with a 30-horsepower engine behind him and trusted the air to hold him up. That is what flying was in 1910. That is what it cost. Most of today's story comes from the Royal Aero Club archives and the work of aviation historian Charles Harvard Gibbs Smith. You can find more at radiohanger.com, Blue Skies and Tailwinds. Friends, go fly something.